sorrow belongs to those that can hear it coming.
A new album from David Bowie on RCA.
Hello, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And I hope that wherever you are, and indeed whenever you are happy and well. Something a little different coming up now. In this new series of episodes, I meet a legend of the Berlin music scene, Manchester-born Mark Reeder. He's widely regarded as a pioneer of electronica and new wave, and has been at various times a musician, producer, DJ, artist manager, label boss, and at all times an absolute icon of the Berlin music scene. Around 10 years ago, Mark was the subject of the fantastic B-movie, an electrifying document of Mark's time at the core of the Berlin underground in the early 1980s. He had actually moved to Berlin in 1978, having been primed by the Manchester punk scene, during which time he was working in the city's most esoteric record shop, the pre-megastore Virgin Records. During that time, he befriended Ian Curtis, he played bass with Mick Hucknall, he argued a lot with Tony Wilson about Bruce Springsteen, and of course he was witnessing the white heat of punk energy burst into flame. His stories are legion and legendary. Now, given that Mark has been obsessed with Bowie ever since he heard Space Oddity as a kid, we probably could have talked about any album, but given his integral presence in the fabric of Berlin's music scene, I felt it would be fantastic to talk about that most Berlin of albums, the 1977 masterpiece, Heroes. And thanks to Thilo Schmidt from Berlin Music Tours, we got to talk in the best place in the world to remember Heroes, Hansa Studios itself, in the heart of Berlin, just by Potsdamer Platz. We were sitting for the most part for this conversation in the corner of the former control room, which is actually adjacent to the main studio, the Meistersaal. And about halfway through this episode, after a little scene setting by the very friendly Hansa employee Daniel, you will hear us actually padding around the mighty vast Meistersaal itself, where the album was recorded. Now, I have to say that the irony of messing up a recording when in one of the most historic recording studios in the world is not lost on me. But I have to apologise, the sound on this episode is a bit patchy in places, which is down to a dodgy mic. Luckily on my side of the chat instead of Mark's. But, you know, it's very punk and DIY ethic, I suppose. Anyway, I hope you can still enjoy our conversation, and I will be bringing you the second part of our conversation, which is recorded a few days later with a much more reliable audio setup where we take on the album actually track by track, and I'll bring you that very soon. But anyway, before then, let's go back now to the early 1960s. It's Manchester, and meet the four-year-old Mark Reeder, whose mind has just been blown by the amazing Tornadoes and their mesmerizing Telstar. How do we get from that to
the 70s?
I've been a music fan.
Yeah.
And, you know, always at every opportunity trying to buy records and things like this. It was important that, you know, I was always interested in the things that weren't on the radio or on Top of the Pops. And so for me, it was always kind of like an adventure to go to the record shop and listen to something new that nobody knew about. And so I was exposed to things like, you know, early Roxy. At night time, I'd secretly listen to John Peel on the radio,
right.
Transistor radio from Blackpool or something. And I would listen to that secretly, pretend to be asleep and listen to John Peel. Go to the record shop on Saturday mornings and see if I could buy whatever it was he played on the radio. You know, and I got to hear quite, you know, a lot of things. Virginia Plain, you know, I hear it, that this is coming out on the weekend, you know, go and buy it.
I remember seeing B-movie, which
which is the movie that came out, what, about 10 years ago now?
It'll be 10 years in 2025.
Scenes where you would go to the Virgin shop.
Well, I worked in Virgin.
Oh, you worked in Virgin?
I worked in Virgin in Manchester.
Yes, that was it.
It was a normal record shop back in 1972, you know. Yeah. Like, and I started working there as a part-timer, as a teenager, because I knew that if I worked there, I could get paid in records. So I didn't get paid in money. I'd just spend it on records. Yeah. But I'd get more records than I would get money. So, you know, it was a win-win situation for me completely. And I got to listen to all kinds of different music there as well. And the colleagues that I had at the shop, they were far older than me, you know. And they would suggest stuff, music that they liked and that they'd grown up with or whatever. And I think the fact that I knew a lot about the music that they already been teenagers when it came out, you know, and my cousin. That's one of the reasons why I got the job in the shop in the first place. I was an enthusiast, you know, and so they let me.
You really knew a lot of stuff. I mean,
I knew a lot of
encyclopedic knowledge.
Yeah.
So working in a record shop only broadened out. It must be a great way to discover stuff.
Unbelievable. I found this music that nobody really was talking about at the beginning, like Faust and Amon Dul, Cannes and all these things. And Virgin were proponents, if you're crowd rock in England, you know, because like they had an advert in the New Musical Express where for 50 pence you could buy the Faust tapes.
I remember that. That's the black and white sleeve, isn't it?
Yeah, some of the type on the cover.
Yeah.
And all this kind of abstract, weird music was different, you know. German music was different to what was happening in the UK, you know. Everything was still guitars and stuff, and this German music was very different. It was all like pieces of, almost like classical music. It was all lots of instrumentals and things. You know, the first Kraftwerk album, which is, you know, it's nothing like the later Kraftwerk albums. It's a bit experimental and, you know, flutes on it and things, you know. And it was just a different form of expression, this music, and I was kind of fascinated by it and also the fact that they had synthesizers, which I was like, since hearing Doctor Who as a child, you know, I was like, I wanted to have a record that sounded like that, you know. And these German records coming from, you know, like West Germany, they had this synthesizer stuff, you know. And I was like, I wonder what it's like Germany, because nobody could tell me what Germany was like. No one had ever met anyone had ever been to Germany. Germany was the enemy. The only people who had anything to do with the Germans were the people who lived across the road, really. They were old people, old age pensions. They'd been in the First World War. First World War.
Wow.
And they'd experienced, you know, trenches and things, trench warfare and that. My father, under the Hunt, he was in the Merchant Navy. He ran away to sea in 1935 when he was 14. And he joined the Merchant Navy. And then during the war, he shot down a Dornier. He never told us. I only found out decades later. Some point, he kind of mentioned it in passing that he'd got a medal for shooting down a Dornier. I never saw the medal until my dad died and my mum was cleaning out the stuff and found the citation and everything. My father was a pacifist. He joined the Merchant Navy. He wouldn't be in the Royal Navy. And I think my father felt very kind of upset that he had to take someone's life. The plane was attacking the convoy, so he had a job to do, but I don't think my father was proud about doing it, you know.
So for your parents, you gradually becoming more entranced by all things German must have been...
It was something that was my upbringing in Manchester, you know, like, surrounded by people who like hated the Germans because they'd been in the war. And I've obviously been the bullied kid, you know.
Yeah.
If you played war, someone had to be the Germans. Yeah. Guess who had to be the Germans, you know, like, if they played Escape from Colditz, that board game, guess who'd have to be the board, the
so
guards, right? I was always the bullied German. So me liking German music in the record shop was nothing really kind of abstract for me. It was like just a progression from my childhood.
How do we then get to the point where you end up being, well, you end up making that move?
In my adventure, if you like, of wanting to find out more about German music, because I knew that the music that we were getting at Virgin Records was only a fraction of what possibly could be available. all these bands that you'd never get to hear because they never had any distribution to the UK, you know. So I was constantly fantasizing that in Germany there must be all this music that I don't know about, and I wanted to go on a journey and find out. So I told my mum I'm going to France, and then I hitchhiked to Germany. We went to Cologne in 1976.
That's your first trip?
The first trip to Germany. And, you know, I was quite apprehensive. I didn't know what to expect from Germany. You know, the mythology of what Germany was about. I hitchhiked and got picked up by this young guy from Cologne. He was very pleasant. Nothing like any imagined dream. In 1976, I came on this trip just to check out Germany and see what, you know, like what record shops have in stock. You know, and I realised, like, oh, there's far too many records here for me to carry in my rucksack. I'm going to have to get a bigger bag, you know.
We're going to need a bigger bag.
Honestly, it was exactly that. I was like, I need a bigger bag. I can't fit all these, you know, about 10 records. I was like, I need a bigger bag. I'm going to have to come back with a bigger bag. So I went back to Manchester. I got a bigger bag. I want the biggest rucksack. What's the biggest rucksack? I want a bricks rucksack. It's got like 80-litre rucksack. It's the biggest rucksack I could find. How many records can I fit in that? I fit 50, 60 records. And then I went on a trip in 77 to Germany, record buying and thinking, I'll go to Berlin. But I was just hitchhiking about. I wasn't kind of like, had any plan or anything. I didn't have a train ticket. And I thought, I'll just hitchhike and see where it takes me. And then go and look at the record shops there. And I was thinking, Berlin, you know, Berlin's in the middle of East Germany. And no one was going to Berlin at all, right? Every car was going somewhere else, but never to Berlin, you know. So I never made it in 77. And then in 78, I was like, maybe on this trip. Yeah, I had an agenda. I wanted to come to Berlin. But I had to go to Dusseldorf and Frankfurt and Munich.
To get to Berlin.
Eventually get to Berlin, you know.
You're getting to Berlin 78. Now, obviously, also, meanwhile, back in Manchester around this time, there's a scene there that's pretty vibrant. So you've got the kind of the punk bands that are playing there. Obviously, you got to know Warsaw very well, Joy Division, all those guys. You get to know Tony Wilson, who I think around that, 78, he would have been doing Factory Club?
Nah. No? In 78, he started the Russell Club as Factory. But I knew Tony Wilson from before that. Tony Wilson was a TV presenter. He was a newsreader, a lot on the local. He'd read the local news at 6 o'clock. He was like a housewife's heart of throb. And he'd come into Virgin 5 minutes before it was closing on Saturday evening. And then he'd ask me, what have you been listening to? He didn't like the fact that I liked Tangerine Dream and Faust and this kind of music. He was like, he couldn't get his head around that. He was into Emmylou Harris and Linda Ronstadt, and his biggest hero was Bruce Springsteen. And he was telling me that Bruce Springsteen's the future of music. And I'm like, no, he's not. He doesn't have any synthesizers on his records. And he was trying to convince me that, you know, this is the future. And I wasn't convinced. So I said, well, what about this? You know, I put something on. It's like, you know, synthesizer. Nah, it's rubbish. It's like, you couldn't get his head around it at all. So I knew Tony from then. I knew Rob Gretton, who was a disc jockey. Pips Disco. I was the guy who kind of like keep the records aside for them to listen to.
You know, music to Rob and to Tony.
Yeah, of course. Like they say, if you hear anything interesting, whatever it is, you know, let us know. You know, so I knew. Okay, Tony Wilson's into this, and Rob was into that. Yeah. You know, and I could put stuff aside. You know, it was only when punk started, that's when a lot of things changed for everybody. Not only for Tony and Rob, but also for me as well.
Yes, indeed, the Buzzcocks, and that's a snatch of their excellent new single, Orgasmatic, one of the best 45s of this winter. Shows how well they have survived the departure of their founder member, one Howard Devoto. Mr. Devoto, though, what has become of this mystery figure, the man who recently thrust a copy of his Spiral Scratch EP into Iggy Pop's hands and said, I've got all your records, now you've got all mine. Well, Mr. Devoto has come out of contemplative retirement and formed a remarkable outfit called Magazine. 2.5 gigs old, maybe 2.5 years ahead of their time. If people tell you New Wave is static or dead, tell them about Magazine. This is Motorcade.
I was listening also to this kind of like, you know, Tangerine Dream, Klaus Schulze kind of music, and suddenly this new kind of music appears, which is nothing like Pink Floyd and nothing like Yes and all this, you know, muso. It was something that was like energetic and it had a statement, because like it was like anger. I was really lucky. job in a record shop. And I was also trying to be a graphic designer. I worked for a graphic design agency, an advertising agency in Manchester, when I got to about 18. So I was lucky I had a job, but everybody else was unemployed. And it was like the energy that this music suddenly brought, this expression of anger, I suppose, of youthful anger. It was like, wow, it was really refreshing. And Manchester's little Virgin Record shop was the only shop in Manchester that sold this music. Everybody else was like, no. If you look at the history of punk as we know it, you know, like the Sex Pistols were started by Vivian Westwood and Malcolm McLaren, you know, it was just Vivian's way of bringing rich kids down to the same level as the poor kids, you know, because she comes from the north and she saw that everyone had no money and no clothes. So she was, and all the fashionable, you know, trendies in London, she wanted to bring them down to the level of the poor kids so the poor kids didn't feel like they were outdone. And they used the Sex Pistols as the catwalk. You had that on one side, but it wasn't going anywhere, and it only went somewhere when once the Sex Pistols played in Manchester and Tony Wilson put them on his telly show. That's what kick-started this whole thing. The Buzzcocks being kind of student musicians, not getting any gigs or anything. Even when they put on the first Sex Pistols concert, they didn't even play themselves. They had a band on called Solstice, they were called, a student union band. They all looked like Jesus. They all had beards and long hair.
When you say Solstice, I've got an immediate mental image of what they
were. They were all, you know, white, flowing, flared trousers and stuff. And they had a little following around, kind of like the student union circuit. So the Buzzcocks put Solstice on as the main act. Sex Pistols as a support act. After that moment, Ian Moss, my friend, he went to that gig. Because I had to go the next morning, it was Saturday morning, I had to go to pick up the records from the railway station in the early morning, at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't want to go out on Friday night because it meant I might miss the train, not get to work on time. So I didn't go. And Ian said, then came on Sunday, I met him in the pub on Sunday, and he went, "Mark, I've seen the future." And I knew that it was right. I knew at that moment that what he'd seen, I should have been there, you know. It kind of made everything sense. Yeah. You know? But it was a while before a first punk rock record came out. It took about 5 or 6 months before the first punk record came out. It was like The Damned, New Rose. Taking the boxes up from Piccadilly Station. And, you know, it's like, I had to open all the boxes, put all the records and stop at 9 o'clock before the shop opened, you know. Damned. Yeah. Just because it looked kind of like demonic somehow and something, like a horror film, you know, like fanatic. I was like, I'll have to hear what this is. And I thought, and it starts like the Shangri-Las. I'm like, what's this? Believe it was like a revelation. I was like, wow, what is that record? Every time anyone came in, I say, you've got to listen to this, you've got to listen to this. And they'd be like, turn that off, it's rubbish. And from that moment, I knew the, you know, the thrill of this new music. Buzzcocks came and sold us a copy of Spiral Scratch. They were only selling Spiral Scratch in your shop because they just had it pressed up. Yeah. So we were the first place to sell it. Like Sex Pistols, I think in the UK, when it came out, I got myself a copy on the Saturday night, went down to a party. And someone put a cigarette on my record, you know. What's that? That's rubbish. That's shit, you know. Stuck his cigarette out on my record. Some Wrangler clad, you know, shoe. It was like being in school, being bullied. Yeah, what's that fucking rubbish?
So it was really tribal, wasn't it? It was really, there was an identity around people that instantly connected to this, that felt that there was something here that was for them. And then the old guard.
You like Led Zeppelin and you like Pink Floyd and you like Yes and you like all those bands and you've got no concept of what this is. And a little bit of it kind of came from just before punk rock actually became punk rock and stuff. I was like into this band. I like Hawkwind because they are synthesized. I like Hawkwind as a psychedelic rock. And there's another band that kind of always sort of hang around with them called the Pink Fairies. Mm. The Pink Fairies were very kind of haphazard and kind of like very transgender as well, their name and the way they looked, and they got songs like I Wish I Was a Girl.
Do they have people from Hopinindon?
No. They were just like three guys. And I was a fan and would go to all the gigs as whenever ever possible and stuff. They played it once. I went down to London. They played at the Marquee. And Lemmy was doing the door. He was taking the money at the door of the Marquee, you know. And it was like this was the precursor, if you like, to what punk rock was. Because their attitude and the things that they were doing was very punk rock. But they had long hair. You know. And then came punk, and it kind of just like, it's like, if you listen to a Pink Fairies record and you don't know what year it's from, you'd think it was a punk record almost, because it's that kind of haphazardly produced.
So there was something in the air.
Yeah.
There's definitely something in the air. People were picking up on this change, this in music, rejecting the very self-indulgent.
Tales of topographic
oceans. So is that how you first came into contact with Joy Division?
I knew Ian Curtis before.
Oh, you knew him?
Before he started playing in the band. He used to work in a record shop called Rare Records, and that he was the youngest person working in that record shop. He was only like 2 years older than me, but he was still the youngest person working in that record shop, and was the only person who would actually talk to me, because I was a kid. And all these like aging hippie guys thought I was just a kid, you know. I was a kid who they'd seen since I was like 8 years old, right? And even as I was getting older, I was still the kid.
Still the kid.
Still that kid, you know. And Ian was the only one who talked to me. And we'd talk about lots of different things. So, you know, it wasn't just about music. I found him like interested persons. You know, he was well read and he had interests similar to my own. So, you know, and when he was quite fascinated that I'd been to Germany.
He was reading lots of German authors.
Yeah.
German filmmakers.
And when we got to the age where we could go to the cinema and watch movies, you know, like there was one cinema in Manchester that occasionally would show things like Aguirre and older films from Germany. We talk about the films that we liked and other subjects, not just Germany, but all subjects as well, you know. So, you know, Ian was kind of fascinated with the esoteric side of things, like, you know, like occultism and everything. So it was kind of, we talk about things like that as well, yeah.
Yeah, from what I've read, he came across as an incredibly well-read guy who had lots and lots of interest.
Well, if you'd live in Macclesfield, you've got not much of an option, have you, really? Right? It's like, you know, there's not that.
This is the result of living in Macclesfield.
It's not, you know, what else have you got to do? The telly was on for a certain amount of time during the day, and you had music and books, and that was it. There was no other forms of entertainment.
When did he first get involved with the rest of the guys that then went up
to become Joy Division? That, as far as I know, Hookie and Bernard, they put up a postcard in that. We had a little message board in the shop, like people could like sell records or whatever, you know, and ask for things, you know. And someone just, you know, they just put up, you know, like looking for a singer or whatever on the message board. And Ian had been in the shop and he took it. Now, I didn't know this at all. I mean, he didn't know that I actually played in a band as well. I joined a punk band as well, like, being inspired by this Sex Pistols and everything. He wanted to get a part of this action, you know, like, I can play three chords. That's all you need. And in the 70s, I'd been in this band called Joe Stalin's Red Star Radio Band. Yeah. We never had
Stalin's Red Star Radio Band.
Yeah. We never had a singer. And it was always like practicing every week, and it'd be like, you know, playing somebody else's music. I wanted to write my own songs, but like the guys, the bass player and the other guitarist, they just wanted to play like Freebird, and it was like that. Come on, you know. Like,
I can't imagine you being in a band where they want to play Freebird.
Yeah, and I'd just be there thinking, I do have to really do this. And eventually I said, I don't want to do it anymore, so I stopped. And literally I left the band and they got a singer.
Yeah.
And that singer was Mick Hucknall. He'd played with another band, like a rock band.
That was Frantic Elevators, wasn't it?
That's what we became.
That's what you became?
I think Mick had only done two gigs with Frantic Elevators. Yeah, he'd only done two gigs with Joe Stan's Red Star Radio Band, and he went to see Sex Pistols. And then he came and he said, I've seen the future.
Yeah.
I want to make a band, you know, with Neil Moss. And it was like, you play bass? And I was like, yeah, sure, of course. I want to be in a punk band too.
So you were Mick Hucknall's bass player?
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
We were the Frantic Elevators, yeah. We didn't do any gigs or anything at that point. We were just practicing, trying to get write songs and be better, be good enough to be able to present ourselves on stage. You know, being on stage doing it is all that matters, right? But Mick, being a bit of a perfectionist, he wanted that we didn't embarrass ourselves at all. But we had to be good enough at least. Right? When we were practicing, he'd take the piss out of other singers and things and do parodies of other singers. That's when you realise that it's got a fantastic voice. As the Frantic Elevators frontman screaming, you know, production prevention or something, you wouldn't really know that he had such a wonderful voice. But when he's parodying Robert Plant or something, or James Brown, it's like,
wow,
you know, he can actually really sing, you know.
All this activity is going on. You're playing bass in this band, you're working Virgin, and then you're also telling me about your trips to Germany. At what point did you make that the final transition to Germany?
I didn't make that as a conscious. That trip in 78 was just a break. Punk rock at the beginning was so exciting and thrilling, and then it started to become a parody of itself. You started to get, you know, comic versions of punk rock records as people started to in desperation, it was all about having a hit record for some point. At the beginning, it was never about having a hit record. It was just about being a form of expression, doing something and connecting with people. But then, you know, the success of some of these record labels, like Stiff, who became immensely successful, suddenly became all kind of majory in their perceptions and stuff. People would just start making records to make money. And then it was no longer... you know, you had Sam Plan Paul Moir, right? You had, you know, Jilted John. And Jilted John went into the charts, you know, became number one. Suddenly it was like a parody record becomes number one. It was a bit shocking in a sense, you know. I was listening to what my friends were doing and just wanting to sort of find out what is happening elsewhere. It was just, I just thought I'd take a break. Virgin Records had become so huge in the meantime that they decided they were going to close our little shop. And in 1979, we were going to be opening a mega store in Manchester. And I'm like, what's a mega store? And the girl who was our manager at the shop, she was like, well, it's something like a supermarket for records. And I just thought, I don't want to work in a fucking supermarket. If I wanted to work in a supermarket, I'd go and work in Tesco's. I could imagine people with shopping trolleys kind of taking Santana and Fleetwood Mac records and putting in the trolley, you know, going to the cash up desk. So I thought, I need a break. I need to go on holiday. So I just went on a record shopping spree to Germany and had a Transalpino, and I missed the fucking train. There was only two trains a day from Hamburg to Berlin, you know, and it was easy in the evening. And I missed the train. It had just left about 5 minutes before. So I was like, oh, I'm going to do. So you could go from Hamburg to Hanover and then catch the train going from Hanover to Berlin. So I was like, right, great. So I got on that train and get to Hanover. Missed the train. Was there any other way to get to Berlin? No, I was thinking, I don't want to spend the night in Hanover. Yeah. And if you catch the regional train, it'll take you to Helmstedt, which is the border between West Germany and East Germany, and you just hitchhike from there. So brilliant, I'll do that. And I did exactly that. Yeah. And I hitchhiked to Berlin in the drizzle. You know, I had no idea what to expect from Berlin at all. Nothing really. I
didn't know anyone here.
Didn't know anybody. And the only images I had been from these movies, Spy, who came in from the cold, and the Quiller Memorandum, what was the other one? Funeral in Berlin, you know, these kind of films, right? Had no real concept of what Berlin looked like at all. I remember some American guy I'd met hitchhiking, he had this book and I was flicking through and I remember reading about East Berlin, you know, the Berlin bit. I was like, I want to go there, I want to find out. And it said you can actually go to East Berlin, and I couldn't absorb the information enough, you know, you need a day visa and stuff. I couldn't remember how do you get to East Berlin. I forgot the name of where you could actually go and get in, you know. It's like getting into a club. And when I arrived, it was like
the pre-Berghain.
It was the hardest club to get into, you know. And I remember, like, the guy who drove me to Berlin, he was a student, and he said, you can stay in our house. It's about to be torn down. You can just stay there. So I stayed in this place. And it was a beautiful, you know, like, a bit like this Hansa Studios decoration, you know, like the parquet floorboards and the frilly bits on the ceiling. It was like, wow, they want to tear down this beautiful house. Marble staircase, a white marble bathroom in the Winterfeldstrasse number 24. It's like, it was directly opposite what was the Fernmeldeamt, you know, the telephone exchange. My bathroom was white marble. It was so beautiful, you know. It was like a palace. I'd come from a fucking council house in Manchester, right? It was nothing compared to this place, right?
Stimme der DDR. Sie empfangen unser Programm auf folgenden Frequenzen. Auf der Langwelle 185 kHz Zehlendorf. Auf den Mittelwellen 611 kHz Schwerin, 692 kHz Wachenbrunn.
That very first morning, I remember going to the end of the street of the Winterfeldstrasse. I thought, I'd better call my mum and tell her I've arrived safely in communism, in the middle of communism. My parents were quite socialist, so they were quite into all that. And at the corner of the street, there was like a little like bar or whatever, a pub on the corner. And I went in and I said to the, entschuldigen Sie bitte, sprechen Sie Englisch? And there was someone stuck in the shelves, and they turned around, and it was this like huge guy with a polka dot top and silver eyebrows and a bright red wig and lipstick. And she went, yes, darling, I speak English. What do you want? I went, I need to change some money so I can make a phone call. And I realised, like, wow, this is just normal, everyday Berlin. Yeah. You can look like that in Berlin and no one cares. Everybody in the place didn't care, you know. Not like in Manchester where you get your head kicked in if you were there. You know what I mean? If you walked out on the street. We had one transsexual person, a transvestite in Manchester, Fufu Lamar, and she had a speakeasy.
Right.
For underage and after hours drinking. It's full of all cops and kids, right? And it was called the Ranch, yeah. And that was the only place that we ever encountered someone like this. And in Berlin, it was like every day. I was like, wow, it was so funny, and it just made me laugh, you know. And I was like, wow, it was brilliant, you know. I thought I'll buy some records and I'll stay for a few days and I'll go to the East, find out what it's like, and then I'll go back and work out what I'm going to do. And I went over into the East, and that was it. It was like, I need to find out more. I need to stay longer, and I never left. Also, I mean, I must confess that, you know, the reason why I'm here is not just because of, like, Krautrock Records either. It's the fact that David Bowie actually made the effort to come here and recorded an amazing record called Low, which was just like nothing. I mean, Station to Station was like, you know, wow, we're a recorder. But then he made Low, and it was like, it sounded like a film soundtrack. It sounded like nothing
so
else.
Low came out in
77. I'd followed Boris since he released Space Oddity.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'd ever heard him. And it was like a song about space and being a kind of space cadet, you know. I was like, it's fantastic. When he became Ziggy Stardust, I was like, oh, what's this? It's because, like, Hunky Dory didn't really resonate initially with a lot of people. Really, it was only when he became Ziggy Stardust that people started to look at the Hunky Dory. I remember taking Hunky Dory into school and almost getting my head kicked in. As a musician myself, you know, you never know when your piece of music hits the right nerve at the right moment. It takes a generation or two, maybe or three, before it suddenly becomes something significant. And I remember, like, young Americans, you know, it's like, what's he doing? He's becoming a disco artist now, you know. When you look at, like, the Ziggy Stardust era, and up to, say, the Hound Dogs, where it was like, you know, like Red Air, suddenly he embraces disco music, music which is kind of like hostile to all the rocker. With Ziggy, you could get away because you had Mick Ronson and you had a guitarist who could play guitar solos, and they'd had Jeff Beck at his last Ziggy show and everything. So he had this connection to the sort of rock and roll, you know, rock and roll star. Suddenly he's become a disco. And for a lot of people, that was like, you know, he's wearing disco clothes. And it was this kind of like ripping of some kind of fabric between rock and roll. And I didn't really like everything, actually. Don't like that track or like that. You know, it wasn't like...
Young Americans.
Yeah, I mean, Young Americans, when it came out, I was like, you know, it wasn't Diamond Dogs. But I liked the idea of like some of the tracks, right? But it wasn't like... It didn't become my favourite album, you know, at that point. It was like, you know, what is it? And then he suddenly made another album that was like totally the opposite. It was completely different. But when he made Low, he was just like, it just kind of like was just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It was just mind-blowing.
So you were already immersed in crab rock and synths and primitive electronica. You loved all this. And so for you,
it was like
just perfection. Yeah,
he's gone from being this disco guy, you know, like trying to find his way in the disco world of America, trying to sell his soul to America, but in reality, he's found it here because he realizes that's where he belongs, you know. And let's face it, you know, Los Negros were the absolute pinnacle of his career, really.
The reason I wanted to talk to you today was about Heroes, and so we find ourselves in the best few square meters in the world to talk about Heroes. There couldn't be a better position on the planet to talk about Heroes than where we're sitting right now.
In the studio room where...
In the corner of what used to be the control room here at Hansi.
No, no.
So where we're standing now, so what would this have been? Would this have been a control room?
Yes, like exactly.
Studio 2?
This would have been...
The Studio 2 was the room over there. So the big hall was the famous big hall by the wall. And this is only the control room. It was very special that the rooms were not connected to each other at all. So they had no direct view or possibility.
That's unusual for a studio, isn't it?
Yeah,
normally in a studio, the control room has a window looking into the studio, but here
definitely.
It would be CCTV maybe?
Yep, they used really old cameras and stuff to communicate with each other.
Yeah,
for sure. So... We're just standing right next to the window where David Bowie stood when he wrote down his notes of the famous song Heroes. And he saw a lady and a man walking past the wall, kissing each other, I guess. I don't know the exact story. There are people that know that much better. Mm. He got inspired by that. And then he wrote down the lyrics and world-famous song was produced or was... started to be
from
produced.
This spot.
From this spot, exactly.
This spot.
And that's the spirit you can still feel. Like if you try to imagine, nothing was here.
Yeah. What we're seeing now are quite modern apartment blocks. In fact, there's a lot here. There are big skyscrapers, apartments, some old buildings here and there. But essentially, it was just
plain field.
Nothing.
Yep. And then there was a watchtower like 200, 300 meters. From that point, and you could see the guards hanging out there. When Bowie and there's a guy called Eduard Meyer, the sound engineer of David Bowie, and they got bored, they pointed out the lights to these guards, and they were afraid that they will shoot back, like crouched under the desk. So it was quite a funny story.
Out of this window.
Exactly, yeah.
And then they're scared that the guards would shoot back. Yeah.
Whoa, crazy times.
So after Bowie left, did he come back here again, do you know?
I have no idea, actually. I know that he and Iggy shared a flat in Berlin at Hauptstraße.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he ever came back after that. I know for a fact that he wanted, or we wanted to celebrate his birthday.
Yes.
A couple of days before or after, I'm not sure. He died, actually.
Mm.
And Of course, he was invited, but he was supposed to be here. But I think he played. He was thinking about coming back for a visit, but nobody knows for sure.
There was a, I think there's a photo when he came to Berlin in '87.
Really?
He played a gig by the wall.
Ah,
and
I
all the kids
that.
In the East were coming up against the wall to listen. And sang Heroes, and he said, this is for all the kids listening.
Sounds like him, definitely, yeah. I mean, I was born in 94, so that's,
so that's
not my decade, but I can imagine that, for sure. Yeah. And David Bowie was the first guy, like, internationally spoken that recorded here. And after David Bowie, all the other international musicians came here, like Depeche Mode, Iggy Pop, obviously, but U2. The last recording that was done here is from R.E.M. in the early 2000s.
R.E.M. were the last band to record here.
Yeah.
And then that was it?
That was it, exactly. After that, the studio said, okay, we don't need the space anymore as a recording booth. Not quite a booth, a recording hall, I would rather say. And that was very special.
Well, Daniel, thank you for
you're welcome.
Introducing this space to us.
Thanks for having
us. It's amazing.
We're going to go and walk inside the actual studio, the Meistersaal. You can hear us talking in the room where Heroes was recorded. It's now an event centre, isn't it?
Yes, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because recording techniques are these days a little bit different. And
So this is it? This is the actual studio?
This is the Meistersaal of Hansa Studios. Yeah.
Can you hear your voice? Hear the unique echo in our voice as we talk. I don't know if this...
It's completely changed to the room that we're just sitting in. But if you look at, you know, it's very high. It's like six metres or something, 5-6 metres high.
Look at that ceiling.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Very well-made ceiling. So this was what, originally a ballroom at some point?
Well, the rumour has it is that the SS used it as a ballroom. But before that, it used to be like a school for apprentices to learn how to be like a mechanic or something.
Oh, really?
Mm.
So this used to be a school?
Yes.
Wow.
Like a bit like a business school or something. Offered.
So it's a very tall room and it's very ornate. We have
wooden
columns embedded in the wall. Beautiful panelling all the way round. I'd read somewhere that they found old swastika-shaped motifs somewhere along here. Obviously, that's gone, been removed. We can see where that would have been. So it was in here that Tony Visconti would have set up his famous three-mic setup, where Bowie would trigger a mic difference when doing the big vocals on things like Heroes, for example. Visconti had set up that system where he lined up three mics, one over the other, and then as Bowie's voice got louder, it would trigger next one until we get to the climax of Heroes, where it sounds like, you know, he's beaming in from the moon.
Yeah, specifically.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. But yeah, what a thrill to be in this room. Heroes was recorded summer 77, I think, and you got here the following year. So obviously you knew that Bowie was here in Berlin.
Yeah.
So my first big obvious question is, did you ever meet him?
No.
Okay. End of podcast.
That's it.
he'd just left when I arrived.
What? But you can tell us a bit about the world that he would have been in, because obviously you would have got to know musicians, you know,
of course.
So you did all of that. I mean, tell us a little bit about the Berlin that you found.
Yeah, the Berlin that I found was this derelict, bullet-riddled, grey, gas-lighted place, right? It was like lit up, illuminated at night with gas lanterns and not colourful in any way. It wasn't like West Germany, it was all chrome and concrete and glass, you know. Berlin was like bullet-riddled, derelict. I couldn't understand why. Bowie's inspired by this ambience, this visual ambience that you can see, you know, that it's like, wow, that's inspiring. There must be other things as well, like listen to the music and knowing that he's obviously influenced by like crap rock records that I've been listening to. I could hear it in the music. I was like, you know, you recorded it here. It obviously rubbed off. I think they recorded Low in sort of end of 76 and it was released at the beginning of 77. Yes. And then they released Heroes in 77 as well, in the summer or late summer or October. Yeah.
I've got to know it's a word. I think he recorded it in quite a short burst from, say, May to about July.
Yeah, it could have been. It could have been.
And everything I've read about it says the sessions are really fun. They finished doing the mixing in Switzerland. They did, I think, about a week of mixing in Montreux. All the recording happened here. Yeah. And interesting thing about the album is most of it was recorded, people like Fripp, who came in and played guitar. Inu was here.
It was all done on the fly.
I know. But the lyrics, the melodies and the lyrics came last.
Just think about the whole thing of like when Heroes came out so soon actually after Low had come out. It was like, I remember we got a white label of Heroes and I was gobsmacked. It was like it was Low had kind of set the pathway really for Heroes, and then Heroes came out and I remember just playing it to death in the shop. Couldn't get enough of the record.
I mean, Low was the big shot, wasn't he? Because this was a completely different, conceptually as well, it was very different. You had these very abstract, electronic, harsh songs. You had this instrumentous summit.
Especially for the fact that Bowie's known for being the singer. I was a fan of, you know, from Roxy Music, I was a fan of Robert Fripp from King Crimson. Then they made a record together. And then Eno went to Germany and made a record with Cluster. So you could see that, like Eno's interest in this kind of about kraut rock music.
Yes.
You know, Bowie was also, having been to Berlin to finish Low, he'd been introduced to people like Edgar Froese. Mm. He was always fascinated. He was fascinated with Kraftwerk and Tangerine Dream. You know, these are the people he was connecting with musically, and you can hear it in.
Didn't he originally want Michael Rother?
I think that was apparently some kind of plan that he had to play Michael Rother, also play guitar on Heroes on the track, but for some reason he didn't play, and then they called up Robert Fripp and said, "Would you like to play some hoary rock and roll?"
So we have Fripp on occasion on some tracks on guitar.
Yeah,
Eno obviously very. This is probably the most Eno-esque album, I think, that he worked on, the Bowie. And then the fantastic rhythm section, George Murray and Dennis Davis.
Yeah.
Carlos Alomar as well. You've got the Dan trio. Certainly Dennis Davis, yeah. Alomar and Murray.
Yeah.
George Murray is one of those mysteries of the Bowie universe in the sense that he's very low profile.
You
don't really hear very much about George Murray. But if you listen to George Murray's work with Bowie, his inventiveness, agility, melody, everything from... When did he start? Was he on Station?
Yeah.
So like Alomar, like what I love about Carlos Alomar is that Bowie would throw anything at him.
Yeah.
Like from Young Americans.
Set.
All the way up. And Alomar would process it and come out as something perfect. And I think there's a quote from Tony Visconti about the making of Heroes, where Visconti just marvels at how Bowie would say, "Right, Carlos, I want you to, you know, do that bit again. Second bit, just make it a bit longer. Third bit, think of something different. And fourth bit, ready? 1, 2, 3, go." And he said, "Carlos would just band.
It just do it.
Come up on the spot." So we have an absolutely shit-hot band here who are the backbone of Heroes. And Visconti says that we all congregated in Berlin with nothing more than chord changes and rhythm ideas. So definitely there were no songs when he came into the studio. Yeah. He'd just been on tour, I think, with Iggy Pop.
Iggy's tour, yeah.
Yeah, on the Idiot tour. So he had really enjoyed this anonymity of being in the band with the Sales brothers, Hunt Sales and Tony Sales, which obviously would come back many years hence. So Visconti says, "We were in Berlin with nothing more than chord changes and rhythm ideas, knuckled songs. Carlos, George and Dennis instinctively knew what to do from the start, but they played harder than the previous album, Low. Low was like learning a new alphabet. Heroes is the Pulp Fiction novel that we created from it."
For sure, yeah.
So this really speaks to your point just now about how Low was the
was the instigator.
Yes, yeah, the instigator. Also, what was really interesting about what you were saying just now about the Berlin you found here, a very dark, bullet pockmarked city, you know, not a bright, sunny place. That's really the feel that permeates Heroes, isn't it? I mean, through a lot of Heroes, you get...
And I think that I started to actually live here as opposed to just hang out here for a while, right? I think that was the thing which makes this album so special, really, is because when he was making Low, he was just here visiting, but when he was making Heroes, it become his abode, it become his home, and he could be very anonymous here. Mm. He could hang out with people, he could go shopping in the supermarket and no one would tap him on the shoulder and go, "Hey, David Bowie." Yeah, it was like he could, you know, just be anonymous and blend in. And I think he really...
He craved that.
He liked that. He could go, because he went back into art.
Yeah.
As a therapy almost, to get away from this whole horror of like California.
Exactly, the big horror of LA. So he'd come a couple of years, I think 76, he left LA just in a complete blizzard of coke and psychosis and management chaos and
poverty,
yeah,
because
he'd been ripped off royally,
you know. And so Berlin was cheap, right?
Yeah,
but Hansa was cheap compared to London or some other studio elsewhere, Paris or whatever. You know, London, Berlin was really cheap, you know?
Exactly.
And it was, and you know, flats were cheap, apartments were cheap. Edgar Froese got him that apartment on the Hauptstrasse, yeah? It didn't have a kitchen. People who'd been in there previously had a fitted kitchen in the kitchen, and when they'd moved out of that apartment, they took the kitchen with them. So when Bowie moved into the Hauptstrasse, there was no kitchen, and so it was the only room in the flat that he had renovated.
Yeah,
the rest of it had never been renovated. It looked exactly the same as it was when he'd moved in. When the people who'd been in before had moved out, it still had the same kind of like wallpaper on. They never did anything. Never decorated.
I've seen pictures of it. I've seen pictures of the interior, and it does look very 70s.
It's
all kind of various tones of brown.
It's like a grey browny carpet, or really cheap industrial carpet on the floor and stuff. And it was like
movie from LA, you know, Rockstar Central LA to that.
He craved that normality somehow. The idea that he could, you know, maybe he also had this kind of, because he had a quite fascination with the Weimar Republic, and I think that also kind of enhanced that feeling, you know. Like, I mean, I must confess, I felt that myself when I got here. It's like, wow, you know, what must Berlin have been like in the 1920s? Yeah, we all know what it was like in the 1930s. But what was it like in the 1920s? Mm. It must have been a fabulous place. You know, you see like this imagery. There's not very much footage that you can consciously see of what Berlin used to look like. That, yeah, you know, that's why I like to watch silent movies about Berlin, because you get to see these glimpses of Berlin, what it used to look like in the 1920s.
That was something that really fascinated him. I mean, he was obsessed with Isherwood. For example, so Isherwood's books about Berlin, Mr. Norris Chain's Trainings, Goodbye to Berlin. I mean, there's obviously a lot of creative license being used, but the essence is this wonderful, intoxicating mix of decadence, of freedom, of abandon, you know, set against the backdrop of Weimar, which was just a very explosive time politically and socially. So, of course, Bowie was really fitting. I mean, you and Bowie really had very similar...
and also the fact that you're in a city which is a dual place, right?
That's the schizophrenic nature. I mean,
and he was into...
Yeah.
The fact that his brother was a schizophrenic, it kind of like, just like, I think Berlin just kind of spoke to him somehow.
And that was me and Mark Reeder, and a huge thanks to Mark for his time and his generosity in sharing his story with me. I'd also like to thank Tilo Schmidt for very kindly arranging our visit to Hansa, and of course the team there, who all made us very welcome indeed. Apologies again for the shonky sound in this episode, but in the next instalment, we're going to be back to more or less normal service. So until then, thanks for listening, and bye for now.